This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A new documentary called The Hungry Heart explores the frightening problem of opiate addiction. It looks specifically at teenagers in the St. Albans area who are trying to overcome their addictions and lead functioning adult lives. In the film, young addicts look into the camera and explain how they started using painkillers at 13 years old, 16 years old, and how quickly their addictions escalated. Some started with a legitimate prescription for painkillers after an injury. Others just experimented recreationally and found themselves quickly hooked.
Normal people wake up and they need to eat and they need to drink some water. You know, they need that food and water. Where I didn't need food and water. I needed OxyContin.
You know how you wake up in bed and you just think, oh, I gotta go get my coffee and I gotta get ready for work. Well, with drug addicts, they say, oh, where's my pill?
The first thing you think about, not like feeding your kids breakfast or, you know, whatever, was like how you were going to get high and how you were going to get money to get high and who you were going to get it from. And it's a whole lifestyle.
And this is just to get me up and functioning. This isn't even, okay, I'm high now. This is just, I'm just getting up and giving my daughter some breakfast.
After a while, you take it not to be sick. You know it's going to happen. You know that if you've been on them for so long, you know how you're going
to
feel.
I needed to get high or I was sick.
Diarrhea, vomiting, headache, room spin.
And everything's going ying.
I just hate the sickness. I'd rather die.
You kind of feel like you're dying too.
The addicts in The Hungry Heart rattle off the labels of the drugs that drove their habits. Vicodin, hydrocodone, Percocet, Dilaudid, morphine, and especially OxyContin. They describe how quickly their bodies got used to a small amount of the drug and how that led them to bigger, more potent amounts. Some of them spent hundreds of dollars a day, thousands of dollars a week, trying to feed their habit of painkillers. And that quickly led to stealing.
A lot of manipulating. Yeah, mom, dad, can I have 20 bucks? I need this.
I'd get paid on a Friday. I'd be broke by Monday. My attitude started changing. That's when I became a very violent person when I didn't have these drugs.
I'd go smash windows out. I'd throw rocks at stuff. I'd break into houses. I'd break into stores.
That's actually how I started my criminal history.
I started stealing stuff from, you know, everywhere, from my mom to everybody in the house.
I was stealing wallets, whole wallets. So I had IDs and social security cards.
I bounced checks all over town. I stole from my mother. I racked up a $10,000 credit card bill.
There was a few times I walked right into a bank and just completely wiped out somebody's bank account.
I've written checks off of an account that was closed for years, which is a felony.
Lost everything. Ended up out on the streets every day. Picking up charges.
Picked up probably 15 charges in the past 2 years. Been to jail 3 times.
I went to jail.
The filmmaker behind the lens on this documentary is Bess O'Brien, and she joins us today. Welcome back to the program, Bess.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
In your last film, Ask Us Who We Are, you explored issues of the foster care system and talked a lot with foster families and children in the foster care system in Vermont. What made you want to turn your focus in this film to opiate addiction and young people?
Well, I had made a film about 10 years ago called Here Today on heroin addiction up in the Northeast Kingdom. So I had sort of been around the corner focused on addiction in that film. And actually, this movie, The Hungry Heart, came to me through my friend over here to my left, Mr. Pediatrician Fred Holmes. He had been working up in the St. Albans area with people around addiction for about 7 years and was interested in really telling their stories, not looking at the statistics, but really delving into the personal stories of his patients. And through a mutual friend of ours, Charles Johnson, Charles said, well, you should talk to Bess O'Brien because she makes these movies raising the voices of people who are often unheard. They're the invisible stories that most people don't hear. And she's made all these movies about different issues in Vermont, and you should talk to her. So Fred called me, and I came up to St. Albans. We had about 4 or 5 community meetings with both his patients, other people in recovery, doctors, concerned citizens. And I showed a couple of my past films to them, and we started to talk about whether this would be a good idea to make a documentary film. So really, this was a film where I was asked to come and look at this subject. And it's been a wonderful experience.
You're a pretty sympathetic eye in this film. I mean, you really are trying to tell people's stories, not a lot of judgment.
No, and I don't think, I mean, my films are really, I think, looking into the intimate world of people who are struggling with these issues. I mean, you know, if you say prescription drug addiction, you could make 10 different movies on that. You could make it on the pharmaceutical companies. You could make it on the whole overprescribing side of it. You could make it on the public policy issues. But this is really a more intimate look at the people who are struggling every day in their lives to get clean. And I think that those stories are important to tell, because I think a lot of times we find those stories on the front pages of papers, and they're ensconced in sort of the criminal activities of these people, and they're sort of sensationalized, or not necessarily always sensationalized, but sort of seen as, you know, a criminal aspect of this addiction. And that is the case. There, many of these people, as you just heard, have to go out and steal and do many things to continue to have their drug habit go on. But I think that the flip side of that is the personal, very challenging and compassionate stories of people who are desperately trying to get off this drug. And that's really what I'm interested in showing. I'm interested in showing those stories and to humanize these people, because they are our neighbors, they are our family members, and they're people that we need to support and help.
Bess O'Brien mentioned the pediatrician in the film, Dr. Fred Holmes, who's really featured prominently in this film as the prescribing doctor for a lot of recovering addicts, and also a driving force behind wanting to make sure that this epidemic is known and talked about. Dr. Fred Holmes is with us today. It's a pleasure to have you on the program, Dr. Holmes.
Thank you very much.
And so is Dustin Maishey, who's also featured in the film and is a recovering opiate addict. Dustin, it's a real pleasure to have you here as well.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Dustin, maybe you could talk a little bit about your story. You know, Bess O'Brien is saying one of the important things to do is really humanize these experiences so it's not just about statistics. And here you are, a real live human being. How did you find yourself even getting involved in opiates in the first place?
My story is a little different than most people's. A lot of them is kind of related to their family, not a good family, not being watched, however that role goes. But for me, I always had a good family, great grandparents, aunts, uncles, the whole family was good. It was just in school and hanging out with all decent people, you know, they're all good kids, but just decided to try it one day. They were doing it and come on, do it type of thing, pressure, and I did it.
And it was pills? Somebody had, what, like OxyContin type pills?
OxyContin, yep. And that day forward, I was like, yep, this is awesome. And it's funny because I know a lot of people that tried it, and it just makes them tired, or they don't like it, it's too much money, and they move on. For me, I knew the first time that it was probably going to be an issue, and that's what it ended up being, for sure.
So it didn't take you very long to realize that this was an issue for you in your life? I mean, there wasn't even that honeymoon period of thinking, this is great and I can control it?
No, that was, I did have the honeymoon stage where I just did it on the weekends, and then it just progressively got worse. Okay, now I need it on a Monday, and yeah, why not Tuesday, and so on and so forth. And it just escalated into, now I can't stop, what do I do? And I tried it on my own, like, oh, this is crazy. I remember sitting on the tailgate with my cousin that had an issue. We're like, we just got to stop this. We can't keep doing this. We're getting nowhere. We both got good lives to look forward to. And we can make it for about 2-3 days, and then it's just too easy to fall back in, and it just progressively gets worse and worse. Then you start doing things that you never expected yourself to do, and no one expects you to do it, and you knew it weren't you, but you there was a problem that you had to fix, and naturally you tried fixing it, and that led me into places and things and I didn't want to be or see. But
that's... You talk in the film about how you stole scrap metal from your farm, you stole from your dad's tool area that he had all these extra tools, and your mom went up once and just you had wiped out $20,000 worth of tools.
Yeah. Like I said, I never stole a thing in my life prior to this. I'm not that type of person, but when you got a habit to feed, like you in the movie, they talk about it a lot. You'll feed it no matter what you have to do to get it or manipulate anybody, or you'll figure out a way. And I seem to be pretty good at that, so they say. When you run out of money, I get paid on a Friday. Saturday, you're broke and you're sick. What am I going to do? So my parents own a bunch of different farms and got a lot of junk metal and stuff. So I was like, Dad won't miss this too much. And so I started taking it in little by little, and then as it got worse, I needed more. I just took more, and then I started taking things that I knew were good. There's scrap metal, then there's metal you can take that's good. And
like
I started,
copper. You took some copper.
That's exactly what it was. Copper is a pretty, it's a gold mine for drug addicts. so we had a couple rolls and took it to the scrap metal yard and got the money, and it didn't last very long. And they found out, and it just weren't good. I knew it weren't me, but that's the way it works. And tools, there was a bunch of tools. They were brand new. They weren't even being used. So I said, if I take these, I don't think they'll miss them. And there again, I got caught, and luckily, you know, every time I got caught, though, it made me think a little more and made me try to do things about it. And eventually I wound up here today talking on the other side of things. So,
yeah, which is a real relief, I bet, to you. And, you know, if you want to be clean and then you are clean, you know, you talk about that a lot in the film, the fear of that, the fear of relapsing, the fear of going off treatment. But here you are clean. How long have you been clean?
I've been clean for December. It'll be 5 years. I still remember walking into Dr. Holmes' office with my mother. I already went to rehab once, came out, did good for a few months, and then got right back into it. And when they found out again, Mom loaded me in a truck, said, "We're going to see somebody. I don't know who it's going to be, but we're going to see somebody." So she brought me to a few different places to talk to people. What can I do with my son? And Dr. Holmes happened to be a place we stopped at. We talked to him, and little did we know, he was a Suboxone prescriber, which first time I went to Maple Leaf Farm, I wanted nothing to do with the Suboxone. I thought it was crazy. I see people running like cows to get it, and I said, no, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it with nothing. And but when we were in his office and he started talking about it, and I told him what I thought of it, and he's like, "Well, you tried it without it, try it with it. It could very well help you. It has a lot of people." So I thought about it, and I ended up going back to Maple Leaf and started on a Suboxone program and got out, followed up with Dr. Holmes, and it was amazing, amazing help. A lot of people look down on it, but I try to talk to people, like coach them that it does get abused, and we all know this, but I was one that wanted to make it work, and that's a big thing with drug addiction, is you gotta want it, you gotta want to change. And I got on it. It helped dramatically. It just took the edge off of trying to get your life back together before to give you some time, basically. I started going to meetings and did all that. And, you know, when people say, "Well, you're really not clean," I say, "Well, I'm not out doing drugs. I'm not on the street buying drugs. I get it prescribed. I don't abuse it. I do exactly what they say to do. I still go to meetings. I do all these things that they tell you to do. And when people say it, I say, well, it's no different than a nicotine patch to quit smoking. When I say that to people, they kind of can comprehend what I'm saying, like to lose weight. People get on weight supplements to lose it, and they see it a little differently. They say, well, why don't you just quit? If it was that easy, no one would have a drug problem. And,
you know, I want to talk about that a little bit more in a little while, but Dr. Holmes, I want to get your input here because, you know, Dustin is talking about his issue. When you start talking in the film, The Hungry Heart, that we're talking about here today, you express some surprise when it first occurred to you or first came to your attention just how many teenagers, kids that you'd been treating as a pediatrician their whole lives, were having a problem with opiate addiction. It was a real surprise to you, it sounds like.
That's a true story. I'd been in practice about 35 years and had always made lots and lots of house calls and went to a lot of interdisciplinary team meetings around kids with special needs. So I thought I was a pretty savvy dude at the time. And when the first youngster came in, I had known him since birth, and he asked me to help him. And I didn't know what he was talking about, but I worked with a Howard Center. I went to Maple Leaf myself.
And Maple Leaf is an inpatient treatment recovery place. Howard Center, one of the designated agencies.
Right, across the street from my office. And looking for advice, and ultimately I took the course and took the test and got the magic number so I could prescribe buprenorphine. Well,
also known as Suboxone.
Correct. When the word got out, you'd think I was the most popular guy in Franklin County. For the first 4 years, we counted up phone calls. There were 3,623 phone calls, and many of them were my patients, youngsters. And we were amazed. I mean, where's this been? Where's this coming from? How come we didn't know about all this? So we started collecting statistics like the average youngster started using when they were 15 and were addicted at 16, and they came in for care at 19. So that's like 4 years unaccounted for during which they're addicted to opiates. And then a dear friend, Katie Tanner, who's also a patient, also in the movie, suggested that we didn't know what we were doing, and people tell me that a lot. So Katie made up a questionnaire, which we gave to the patients, and Katie wrote it herself from her perspective as somebody was struggling with addiction, and it was startling. The number of kids who never completed high school, came from broken homes. How long does it take you to get drugs? What's your drug of choice? How do you use it? Just stuff that I would never think to ask. So we were faced with a situation where I figured out that we didn't know what we were talking about. So we asked the kids, we actually had a questionnaire that we gave them. When did you first start using? What would you like us to know about? And the kids started writing their stories, pages and pages and pages. So we collected them. We reproduced them. Bess got a copy. And then we were asked to testify at the State House before Eric Holder and Patrick Leahy, and it's really funny because they leave as soon as the talking starts. Anyway, so rather than blow another bunch of statistics, we prepared a DVD of some of the kids telling their stories, and that's what we played at the State House. So the kids were with me. We played the DVD. They came to talk to us afterwards, and it made a huge impact. So it occurred to us that maybe these youngsters would be treated with more respect, which is what they deserve, if people understood their stories. And that's the community meetings and meeting with Bess and starting the movie. And
was it hard, though, to ask your patients and your friends, as you call them, to come out and talk about something that in many cases feels like a very shameful part of their lives and then make that so public?
No. And the reason is I don't talk to anybody about their addiction any different than I would talk to anybody about a sore ear or a sore throat. I mean, they're good people. They've been through a difficult time. They have a horrible illness. But they're not those kids. They're just like any other youngster who happens to have a different illness. So you don't talk to them any different. You don't talk down to them, or you don't be dismissive or judgmental. And when I hear other providers refer to, even to this day, when I hear other providers refer to them as, what the guy said was, those kids who think they can walk in with a medication list and expect me to treat them. And I'm thinking, he doesn't get it. They're not those kids. So it's just another conversation, a patient, respectful, non-judgmental, usually very enjoyable conversation.
We're discussing opiate addiction and a new Vermont film that explores that problem, particularly among teens.
Those who would suggest that they're getting what they deserve, that's inhuman. I believe that they have a very serious illness that they did not choose. It's very difficult to treat. It's a relentless, relapsing illness that's potentially fatal. It's expensive. It gets them in trouble with the law. It blows their relationships with most people in their lives. It's a horrible illness. And so our obligation is to help them treat that illness.
That's Dr. Fred Holmes, a St. Albans pediatrician, in an excerpt from The Hungry Heart. Dr. Holmes is one of my guests today, along with one of his former patients, Dustin Machy, who's in recovery, and filmmaker Bess O'Brien, who directed the film. And listeners, again, you can share your experiences with opiate addiction or your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Dustin Machy, just before the break, we were talking to Dr. Holmes, and he said this is just like any other illness, and you treat it just like any other illness. And you mentioned that as well, going on Suboxone, this treatment for opiate addiction. You know, you saw that as a medication that you take to make sure that you can get off the addictive drugs that were not good for you. So do you see it as a chronic addiction, as a chronic medical condition, opiate addiction?
This has been a big topic with drug addiction. Some people say it's not. It's they started it. So I think that it is. I've heard it enough. It's something that you don't ask for. And this, you don't look up at the sky and say, God, please strike me as a drug addict. It happens. And then you treat it as it was an illness, because that's exactly what it is. I mean, most people I know that have been abused drugs or a drug addict are very good people, no different than anybody else. They just get in this trap, and it's hard to get out of. You fall down a lot, you just pick yourself up and try it again, keep going at it, just like a boxing match. Get knocked down, get up. And but yeah, I do look at it like any other illness. No one asked for it. No one wants it, but it happened. And
Dr. Holmes, how does Suboxone work to treat opiate addiction?
Well, the basic thing is it's a replacement opiate. So that what you do is essentially, here's where I get in trouble, you replace an illegal opiate addiction with a legal opiate addiction. And by helping them block their cravings, control their medication, monitoring their urine, using the Vermont prescription monitoring system to make sure that everybody's being honest in this process, it gives them an opportunity to start the learning process to perhaps pull their lives back together again, and then it's no longer needed.
So you do wean people off Suboxone?
Oh, for sure. The hard part is, the really hard part is that there will be people who require Suboxone all their lives, just like people who require methadone or Prozac or Zoloft or what have you. And you do not know which or which up front. But the bigger problem is, I believe it's fear. Unfortunately, and this bothers me a lot, we leave the kids with this message that they have to have this medication to lead a normal life. And I think for many of them, that's really unfair. So we have an obligation to help them wean off as soon as possible. But they're scared stiff. They're afraid that if you take that magic prescription away, they'll revert to behaviors that were very unpleasant and ruined their lives and got them in trouble. So I think the most important part is a gentle landing, a gentle finish to the conversation.
Let's go to Lori, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
First, I want to give kudos to Dustin for his work. My son is also, actually not currently, but was addicted to opiates. He went to the Hazel Foundation in Minnesota for his treatment. But my comment is related to driving while taking Suboxone. Several years ago, my son was stopped, and during that police stop, he told the officer that he was taking Suboxone, and he was charged with driving under the influence of drugs. He wasn't drug tested or anything. He just admitted during that stop that he was taking Suboxone. The charge stuck, and he now has a criminal charge. It's driving. It's like a DUI, driving under the influence of drugs. I was shocked at this, and I was also shocked that that would stick, but our lawyer informed us that this was a legal charge. So that is what I just wanted to put out there. And as I said, I was just shocked that this was possible.
Lori, thanks very much for the call. That's an interesting perspective that I hadn't heard about. Dr. Holmes, how do you deal with that? I mean, as you say, you're replacing an illegal opiate addiction with a legal one. Lori's saying her son got a DUI because of it.
I've never heard of that. Sounds horribly unfair. There are people who take opiates in appropriate doses for a variety of reasons, and Suboxone just happens to be one of them. And if you're doing what you're supposed to do and taking it the way you're supposed to take it, I don't think you should be charged.
Bess O'Brien, you did want to include in the film, The Hungry Heart, the downsides of Suboxone. You include, in fact, a young woman who overdosed on Suboxone and died. Mm-hmm. Is that an important thing to keep in perspective as we look at this issue of opiate addiction?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, part of the problem here is that nobody is the same. And Suboxone is a tool in the toolbox, along with AA and NA and yoga and God and, you know, talking to your friend and going to therapy and hiking. I don't know what, you know, I don't know what all the ways of getting clean are, but I'm sure there's thousands of different ways. And so Suboxone is one of the ways. And for some people, it's the thing that helps push them over into a place where they can finally get their life together. For other people, it's like, I'm never touching that thing. I don't like it. In the same way with AA. I mean, AA works for a lot of people, but I interviewed people who were like, I would never walk into an AA meeting. I don't like sitting around it. You know, a circle and talking to other people about my addiction. So the fact of the matter is, I mean, just like Dustin said, to me, Suboxone is like the nicotine patch. It's one way to stop smoking. Some people stop smoking by just saying, I'm stopping smoking today. Other people, it takes them 29 times to stop smoking. Other people take the patch. Other people do meditation, you know, whatever. So I think, you know, part of the issue here is that Suboxone is one of the things that we need to have available for people. Because a lot of times, and I think Dustin can say this, a lot of times you try many things to get clean. And along the way, I mean, Dustin tried going into treatment. That sort of worked. But then it was Suboxone and treatment coming together that finally got him clean. And yes, of course, nothing is black and white. Suboxone can also be abused, and addicts are really smart, and they can figure out how to use Suboxone in a way that they can shoot it. And when you shoot it, you get high. And unfortunately, in my film, there is a story of somebody who dies from being addicted to Suboxone. So, and I put that in there because I thought it was important to show all the different sides of this, and to not just say this is a miracle drug. For every single person, that we have to be careful with it, we have to monitor it, but that it should be out there and it should be a part of the myriad of different ways of getting clean.
We got a note from Amelia in Brattleboro who says, I think it's hard for people to understand that addiction just happens. I think the first illness is trauma that people try to heal by using drugs. The second illness is addiction. Mm. Dustin, I'm curious for you how you stay clean now. You're not on Suboxone anymore. What kind of outlets do you use, or you know, how do you make sure that you stay clean?
Well, it's been almost 5 years, and it's been long enough for me to just all the tools I used. I went to AA in the beginning. Actually, for me, I know Beth said that it don't work for everybody, which it doesn't. But for me, it's if I need that, I mean, I'll go here and there, not as much as I used to. Like the first year and a half, I went like every day, Christmas, birthdays, it didn't matter. I was there every single day. And I just kind of, all the things I learned throughout helped me today. I got a very good family support system, my wife, my parents, brother, sister, aunts, uncles, grandpa, the whole family is just always there. If I need something, ask me how you're doing, how's your day going, just all these little things and the love just that they give you makes you not want to go back and hurt them like you had before. And after a while, after a while, you run out of chances, and people start, you know, okay, well, I give you five chances, and they're gone, and I'm not willing to lose that today. And so, just like Beth said about the toolbox, you get all these tools and you just use them. And for me, I when I get mad, upset, something happens, that's the furthest thing away from my head. Oh, a pill will take that away. It doesn't come to my head. There's many other things. I know by doing that, it's going to give me another problem. I'm going to have to deal with what I had to deal with in the beginning and deal with the drug abuse and going all back through what I went through, and I'm not willing to do that. So,
Dr. Holmes, just before we go, you know, that is a point that you point out in the film, though. You know, Dustin has a great family strength and family structure, and not every kid that you work with has that. And we may have Suboxone for some of the kids that you treat, but if they have few job prospects, haven't been able to finish an education, and don't have other people in their lives who are looking out for them and loving them, it's really hard to make sobriety stick.
It's extremely difficult. And for many youngsters, it's like a Chinese menu. It's education, transportation, housing, food, mental health, substance abuse. It's a daunting task for them. And trying to build that network of support around them when they have difficulty advocating or respecting themselves is very difficult.
That's Dr. Fred Holmes. He's actually a recently now retired pediatrician in the St. Albans area. Dustin Maishi has also been talking with us today about his experience with opiate addiction. They're both featured in the new documentary, The Hungry Heart, by filmmaker Bess O'Brien. Thanks very much to all three of you for coming in and talking today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you very much.
And we have information about screenings of The Hungry Heart up at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition. Coming up, a new charter is being floated by the Quebec Premier that would restrict what kind of religious accoutrement public servants are allowed to wear. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Over the last several weeks, a hot topic of discussion north of the border has been the Charter of Quebec Values, floated by Premier Pauline Marois and the Parti Québécois. The charter would forbid all public employees from wearing overt and conspicuous religious symbols and headgear. Joining us to explain further is McGill University Professor of Law and Philosophy, Daniel Weinstock. Professor Weinstock, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So what are the basic tenets that this charter is calling for?
Well, there's basically two elements. The first one, which is really not all that controversial because it just summarizes things that are already part of, as it were, the legal environment in which religious accommodations are granted, is to say that we need to have a clear sense of when it is and when it isn't okay to bend a rule of a public administration, of a public institution, rather, in order to accommodate people's religious needs, for example, for a prayer room or for special dietary restrictions. The thing that's really sort of a hot button is that the law would essentially prohibit all people who draw a salary from the state. So not just people who are dealing with the state, police officers, with the population in some kind of an authoritative capacity like police officers, but anybody who draws a salary from the state would have to remove all distinguishing religious signs, all overtly religious signs. The word that's being used in French is very difficult to translate. Ostentatoire sounds like ostentatious, but not exactly the same thing. So the idea is very sort of bold, big symbols like hijab, a scarf on
a yarmulke as well.
Or a yarmulke or a Sikh turban, for example. Exempted are discreet sort of pendants like little crosses. You know, you can already imagine how much controversy this is raising because one can imagine public officials running around with little rulers trying to determine whether a symbol is discreet enough or not. But that's the basic gist of it. The idea is that people who represent the state, people who draw a salary from the state, should be religiously neutral, and that religious neutrality should translate in the way that they appear.
And when you talk about people who draw salaries from the government, I mean, as you said, it's not just police officers. This would include so many daycare workers, school teachers.
That's right. So, you know, it includes a lot of people who never see any member of the public. There was a lady who called in on a call-in show the other day and said that she's a lab technician in the Ministry of Health. She never sees anybody from the public at all. Why would she be required to take off her hijab? But, you know, the hot-button issue are school teachers and daycare workers. Daycares, public directly financed acres have been way into the labor market for a lot of recently arrived women from North Africa, which is a region that Quebec has drawn a lot of immigration from in recent years. There are women who've been working in the daycare system for, you know, over a decade, who are now being told that if this law passes, and it could be introduced in the National Assembly as early as this fall, in the next few weeks, they would have almost from one day to the next to remove a religious symbol, which in many cases means a great deal to them, and that would place them before a very, very difficult dilemma.
I would imagine that's causing quite a stir then, people thinking, could this really happen?
It's causing a huge stir. It's probably the most divisive debate that I remember here in Quebec. It's a chapter of a debate that we've been having for the last few years. But the fact that now we have a very stringent regulation that is being proposed, not yet as a, this isn't a bill that's been introduced in Parliament. This is an orientation document that the government has floated in advance of introducing legislation. But the proposal is that religious freedoms would be limited in a fairly serious way in order to achieve the desired goal of state neutrality. Some people feel that it's perfectly appropriate for the state to do so, looking at countries like France and Belgium, Francophone countries, where the ideal of laïcité is very strong. Other people feel that this is appropriate for slightly different reasons. Immigrants should come to a new society like Quebec and change their ways to look and appear and act more like the members of the majority. But for people who, think that limitations of individual freedoms really have to be justified extremely stringently, extremely closely, and limitations can only be as parsimonious as possible, this is causing quite a lot of concern.
Looking at the motives behind Premier Pauline Marois and the Parti Québécois introducing this, does this have anything to do with the separatist agenda? The Parti Québécois would one day like to put forward a referendum.
Well, I think that politics is never really very far. The Parti Québécois was elected to government with a minority government, but in the first few weeks of its mandate, was doing fairly poorly. A lot of botched sort of initiatives by rookie ministers who had been placed in very demanding portfolios who just weren't ready for prime time, and their numbers were really plummeting, such that at a certain point they were sort of threatened with third party status had an election been called at that point. I think there is a calculation here that there are a lot of people, let's call them conservative nationalists, people who feel that Quebec has gone too far in accommodating people of different religions, recent immigrants, and that this should be reined in to some degree, are very alive or very sensitive to the message that the PQ has been throwing out. So the idea is that this will stabilize the PQ's electoral base. Now, the other part of the agenda is that, were this stabilization of the electoral base to translate into a majority government in an election which could be held as early as December 9th is one of the dates that we've been hearing, that could give the PQ, the Parti Québécois, the power to introduce stringent legislation which would almost be made to order to be in violation of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Now, you would think that that's something that a government would want to avoid, but a government that has as its first article in its charter to remove Quebec from Canada is in the business of creating crises, is in the business of creating perceptions on the part of the population that Canada is really just too much of a constraining legal environment for us to be able to do what we want to do. And so the idea would be that this kind of engineered crisis could perhaps be one of the elements of the recipe for a successful referendum.
And just to go back and clarify for people who haven't been following politics very closely, the Parti Québécois is in a minority government right now, a coalition
That's right.
government.
So there are three parties that are presently in the National Assembly, well, four actually. The Parti Québécois, the Liberal Party, the two parties that have essentially traded off power from one another for the last 40 years, and two upstart parties, a left-wing party, which stands to gain quite a lot from the disaffection that a lot of Montreal-based, more cosmopolitan intellectuals who may traditionally have been Parti Québécois voters have been feeling towards this legislation. So that's a party called Québec Solidaire. And then a party that sort of came up as a none-of-the-above alternative party, the Coalition for the Future of Quebec, Coalition Avenir Québec, which elected a good number of MNAs. So it's a divided, sort of fragmented National Assembly, which has made it very difficult for the Parti Québécois to do much of anything in its first year in power.
Well, and we're going to have to see if snap elections are called and if this charter that's been floated by the Parti Québécois and Pauline Marois goes anywhere. Daniel Weinstock is a professor of law and philosophy at McGill University. He's been telling us about this proposed charter of Quebec values that would forbid public employees from wearing religious symbols and headgear, overt religious symbols and headgear. Professor Weinstock, thank you very much.
Not at all.
A band in Brattleboro is making waves in the music scene near and far. The members of the band have been together for years, but they're still not even eligible to vote. They call themselves the Snaz, and VPR's Susan Keese has more. And that'll do it for today's show. Bob Kinzel has a preview now of tomorrow's program with Vermont historian Paul Gillis.
He's just written a book that traces many of Vermont's current laws and legal philosophy back to the people and events in the 19th century. We'll look at many of these connections.
And you can listen to that tomorrow at noon and 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.